Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Strap on your parachute. It's time for What Goes Up.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg. And this week on the show, we'll talk about how everyone is expecting this year to be a blockbuster period for the economy, with the Federal Reserve expecting U.S. GDP to grow by 6.5%. Our guest is optimistic about growth as well, but not quite as optimistic as the Fed. We'll discuss why and what it means for how you should allocate your investments this year. But first, let's let Charlie Pellett tell us who this week's mystery co-host is.
This week's mystery co-host is Scarlett Fu. Scarlett is an anchor for Bloomberg Quick Take and a veteran of Bloomberg Television and Bloomberg News. She's an avid mountain bike rider who actually taught Mike Regan everything he knows about the Bloomberg Terminal. Of course, she's still way faster than Mike, both on a mountain bike and a terminal.
You know, Scarlett, I'm going to have to talk to Charlie about these introductions. He's getting some insults in on me there. But it is true. I assume you are still faster on than me on a terminal and a bike.
I'm faster when I'm typing and using shortcuts on Microsoft Word. I'm not sure about on a mountain bike, especially going downhill. I tend to be pretty cautious when going downhill. And uphill, I'm not too fast either, but we're working on that. Also, being introduced by Charlie Pellett is amazing.
Isn't that? It's a great perk of doing this podcast, having Charlie do the intros and a little insult comedy once in a while as well. But Scarlett, talk to us about Quick Take. I'm very excited about all the plans in the work for Quick Take. Is Chris Paul, NBA star Chris Paul, is going to be doing a show? I hope he doesn't mess up the groove in your seat, though.
No, I think he's got his own seat. He's got his own table. He's got his own room. He'll be doing his own thing. I'm not totally sure what it's going to be yet. And in fact, even if I did, I couldn't say anything because there's going to be a big release on April 20th. But in the meantime, we're doing a lot of good work just on covering the business news stories, more from a consumer perspective, rather than for the Bloomberg Terminal client and customer. So it's a really interesting time, obviously, given what's happening in the markets and the economy and with all the different social justice movements as well. And this focus on equality, which is something that I've been doing a lot of work on over the last couple of years with Bloomberg Equality.
It's excellent. I'm really looking forward to the launch of the new primetime lineup. And of course, as always, you can watch Scarlett anchor during the day. Scarlett really did teach me everything about the terminal, by the way. I don't want to date a Scarlett, but
please don't.
Way back in 2007. Oh, whoops, I already did. Too late.
I think you were a little generous with the date there, but that's fine. I'll let you get away with that.
Fair enough. 2000 and it was, I think. But anyway, let's bring in our guest here. We're very excited to have him. He is the chief portfolio strategist at State Street Global Advisors. So he can talk about all manner of macro markets and the economic outlook and everything in between. His name is Gaurav Malik. Gaurav, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Michael. Nice to be here, Scarlett.
Well, thanks for your time. We really appreciate it. And let's start with that discussion about GDP this year. I know you guys are a little more conservative in your estimates for GDP this year than, say, the Fed is. Walk us through about why that is. I mean, still, I think, regardless, we can expect a pretty much a blockbuster year for economic growth, especially compared to what we've seen, say, in the post-financial crisis era. But walk us through what you're thinking about growth this year and kind of how it'll play into the markets.
Sure. So we are expecting a little bit lower, as you said, than the Fed. I mean, I don't want to read too much into it as well. I think that our expectation is that both the pace at which things start opening, the pace at which consumers start spending, business spending starts picking up, all that from a timing standpoint could be a little different than what the Fed is assuming right now. So our expectation is things are going to take a little bit longer to normalize. So from our perspective, 2021, maybe a little bit behind the Fed, but then as you start looking at 2022, perhaps even a little bit ahead of the Fed at that point in time. So it's a bit about timing as to what's the path to normalization and a bit about other factors. I mean, there are some odd things we're seeing in consumer behavior. The fact that, you know, stimulus checks went out, people are, of course, spending a bit of it. People are indeed using it to pay down debt. Some of it is going into savings. So all those factors keep us a little bit behind the Fed as we look at 2021 and a little bit ahead, perhaps, as we look at 2022. But all in, I agree with you. This is going to be a blockbuster year, the best we've seen in decades.
Okay, so maybe 2 or 3 years out, it'll all even out with what the Fed is projecting, with what you're projecting. I wonder, though, with the rest of the world opening up at a slower pace than the U.S., what does that mean in terms of consumption in the United States? Because a lot of the times people are spending their money and they're having these experiences traveling out of the country, spending their dollars outside the U.S. People aren't really leaving the country now. What does that mean for domestic demand and the kind of consumer spending we can expect over the next couple of years?
So you're touching on a very interesting point, right? So one of the reasons why in some ways we say that, you know, as we think about not only just U.S. GDP, but global GDP, even in global GDP numbers, we're perhaps a little bit behind consensus forecasts is because exactly what you said, the fact that consumers are going to be spending a bit more domestic, but not as much as they would have spent when they're traveling to, let's say, Europe or Asia. And we also think that the recovery is going to have a rolling, it's going to be in waves or rolls. So right now, U.S. is taking the lead. I don't think that the current pace of vaccinations, everybody knows it's been slow in Europe, but I don't think we should make the assumption that it'll forever be slow in Europe or in Asia. I think they will pick up. So there's going to be a bit of a baton handing that's going to occur from U.S. to Eurozone, Eurozone to EM. So some delays occurring as you think about that rollover occurring, but absolutely correct. The fact that consumers are going to be spending a bit more domestically does lift up the U.S., but the fact that they will not be spending as much internationally means perhaps airlines were not going to be running as many routes as they do internationally, revenue impact. So some of those delays that might occur because of timing are the reasons why you might see some differential behavior and perhaps some better impact in the U.S. immediately, but then some slowdown as you think about the other parts of the globe.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting too, Gaurav. You wrote a little bit about external leakage, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding that, but I sort of picture that as, you know, stimulus money being spent by the U.S. government, kind of then in turn being spent on imports and stuff like that. Walk us through how you're thinking about that and also how you're thinking about sort of the path going forward for fiscal spending. Are we really going to see this infrastructure package that is being discussed, or is it going to be, my guess is we might have kind of a rocky road to get to that, perhaps disappointing the markets a little bit. I don't know, but I'm curious how you're thinking about all those issues.
Yeah, so I think that first on your initial question about leakage, yes, absolutely. It's sort of, you know, partly to do with imports, partly to do with savings. And I think one of the things that has definitely changed for the U.S. consumer from a behavior standpoint, I mean, you guys know this, right? Like, two of you were dating your years or your age, perhaps, in this process. But clearly, you know that 2000s, beginning of 2000s, the U.S. consumer was consistently in deficit. We were spending more than we were earning. And then post 2008 and GFC, we've seen a change in behavior where the U.S. consumer is actually beginning to save more. And that does indeed continue, even as we look at the effects of the stimulus most recently. More money being used to pay down debt. So I think part of the behavior, absolutely correct, is that the savings is driving some of that behavior. And some of it is also timing in how consumers choose to spend that money. Delaying certain decisions to perhaps later in the year. And all those things do factor in as we think about that leakage occurring through. And remind me again, what was the second question you had?
Oh, I'm curious what you think about this next phase of fiscal spending, the infrastructure package that we keep hearing about. Is it, my guess is it's going to be, that's going to be a tough negotiation, sort of a hard fought negotiation, and perhaps maybe the market might be disappointed. I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, so I think there's two ways to think about it. So I agree with you that there is going to be some disappointment along the way. I think Biden is doing everything he can to make sure we get to some outcome, and everybody acknowledges that this type of spending has to occur for a variety of reasons. As you know, I mean, you said in my title, Chief Portfolio Strategist, but one of the things I do is I work with various institutions from sovereign wealth funds to pension funds across the board. They're hankering for assets that have long duration and give big streams of income, you know, beyond 30 years even. So there is a need for the infra spend. There is demand on every side. It is going to be a little bit difficult. So, you know, agree with that aspect. I think the way we think about it in some ways from a market standpoint, I'll shift gears for a second here. So how do we play that to have the greatest chance of success in terms of getting the returns we expect from that Biden stimulus? And we think the highest beta for that is actually in materials. It's a sector which has, you know, supply constraints around it. It's a sector in which we don't see, we see a lot of discipline in terms of ongoing investments. So when we think about playing out the Biden scenario versus what actually gets realized, we think materials is a good place to be, to some extent industrials too, but materials is a nice place to be for a reasonable length of time to play the Biden infra plan.
I'm glad you bring up infrastructure, Mike, because my son is looking to be a structural engineer because he is graduating from high school this year. Mike and I talk a lot about this whole process of getting your kids to college, and hopefully there will be some bridges and tunnels for him to construct once he graduates. Gaurav, I want to get your thoughts on the labor market, in particular, the labor shortage that we seem to see across so many different parts of the economy, whether it's in the seasonal hospitality industry or the trucking industry. Everyone's saying that they're going to have to start paying workers more to get more people into these kinds of jobs. How are you thinking about wage inflation and what that means for your investments?
Yeah, so I think that the way we think about wage inflation is what are the temporary pressures and then what are sustainable long-term pressures. On a temporary basis, there is a lot of pressure on wage, right? So not only is it all the segments and sectors you spoke about where there is a shortage of labor, also the ongoing pressures to raise the minimum wage. Now, the question worthwhile asking is that, is this something that occurs in 2021, or is this something that results in a sustainable move where we can expect to see some reasonable levels of wage growth over the next 3 to 5 years? And I think that's the place where we struggle. So we do think that temporary shortages are going to be there. But as things open, as we get closer to that full employment number, we're still faced with the same problem that we had in some ways in the Trump administration, right? That you had full employment, you had labor shortages, you did see some wage growth, but nothing that leaked its way through for there to be inflation on a more sustained basis. So I would say temporary pressures, definitely it's going to play itself out. I do see a bit more of a shift occurring towards labor versus capital, call it. However, for it to be sustained, I think there is more investments we need to make in infra, in productivity, in tech. Those things do need to continue fast rate so that workers indeed can have more sustained sources of earning those wages and for us to see a sustained growth in those.
So Mike and I are selfishly wondering here whether that means his daughter and my son will actually be able to make a living wage and not live in our homes.
I mean, I think that, you know, you've also seen the trend, right? That college educated, I think that that's an area that continues to garner and continues to have some reasonable level of bargaining power. So I think maybe the future is brighter.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Scarlett, talk about dating us there with our college-bound kids.
I know,
that's
really, it's true.
But I'm just impressed your son has a major picked out. My daughter's fluctuates depending on what show she is binge watching. So she was watching Grey's Anatomy for a while and wanted to be a pediatrician and then moved on to something else. And I think it was FBI agent for a while. So I got to get her back. They need to add more seasons to Grey's Anatomy because I want to get her back on that focus. But Garv, you know, the whole market until about a month ago, was just entirely fixated by what we were seeing in the treasury market and this sort of sudden jolt higher in yields. Yields have since cooled off a little bit. It kind of looks at least like a short-term high, possibly, maybe, perhaps is in. But I wonder if that is really true. I mean, how are you thinking about yields? Is this cooling off period that we're seeing here now doomed to fail? Are higher yields just inevitable given the backdrop of GDP growth that we're seeing and at least a short-term pickup of inflation? I mean, is this kind of a bull trap for Treasury buyers right here?
Well, I mean, I think that some level of yields going up, I think, has to happen with the amount of growth we're seeing. I mean, you know, on a long-term basis, 10-year yields should be mirroring whatever is the GDP growth. The current pickup, obviously, 5.6% for us or 6.5% is obviously not sustainable. You start looking at 2-3 years, you're looking again at that 2-2.5% number. So some move up, definitely going to happen. The question is how much? I mean, you know, we don't see it going much beyond the 2.25, 2.5. And if anything, if we saw yields broach past those levels, I'd say we'd be thinking about saying, well, maybe we should extend duration in those situations. I mean, on a broad basis across our portfolios, we're underweight bonds, we're underweight duration. But as it approaches us those levels, we think there may be room to think about buying treasuries. I mean, keep in mind that there are these long-term pressures that the Fed has to deal with. And some of these are political in nature too. Things, you know, we spoke about wage growth, we spoke about college educated. Inequality continues to rise. And in fact, through the pandemic, some of these structural forces like inequality have increased over this period. That is going to put a lid on how much high rates the Fed will tolerate. The language out of the Fed on extended stimulus and what they need to start breaking out suggests to us that you can see yields move up. There is definitely room to move up in such a robust growth environment. Not beyond certain high levels, though. And for us, that number is somewhere around, you know, call it 2.25, 2.5, where we start seeing, you know, the other way, downward pressure occurring. The other thing to keep in mind is that much as we can have a long-term bearish view on bonds, the fact that institutional investors on a long-term basis do need long-duration assets just to meet their obligations, and the fact that still, when you think about hedging against any shocks in the equity markets, the long duration treasuries are seriously your best bet. And it's interesting that if you look at the period post GFC, even though we've seen all these forces play out in terms of globalization taking a step back on a trade basis, financial globalization, the effect of the dollar has simply increased in markets. So even if you're sitting in India today or China, and you want to hedge some of your stock positions, well, US Fed is still a really good use to do that. So demand plus the fact that that it is really one of your best diversifiers puts a lid on how far the Treasury yields can go up.
How do you see foreign demand for Treasuries playing into this? I mean, I know a lot of it ties back to how different economies in the emerging markets are faring. But do you see demand from the likes of China, from Japan, from other countries around the world changing at all in the next foreseeable future, in the next year?
I know I don't see that changing materially. I mean, I think that there is always competition as to which currency can be a strong substitute reserve to the dollar. But really, nothing has emerged. China is trying its best to position the renminbi as a reserve currency. We've seen the euro do that and take away some market share. But I think still, the main reserve currency, the main buyer of things in the world, the fact that we still run a pretty hefty current account deficit here, tells us that demand for U.S. assets, U.S. treasuries is going to continue staying robust. I think the other thing to keep in mind also is that right now, as we look from a market's perspective, as we think about earnings growth, we think about growth, everything we've been discussing so far, you know, U.S. exceptionalism continues across the board. That means that investors outside the U.S. certainly demand more and more U.S. assets. So I don't see the demand situation changing that dramatically because of course, the unique status the dollar enjoys as a reserve currency.
You know, Garv, I'm famous for asking like 12-part questions, but I'm going to take it easy on you and only ask a 2-part question. And that is because I know you guys at State Street, you know a thing or two about ETFs, if I'm not mistaken. And we've just seen such a massive inflow into ETFs this year. Mutual funds as well, but really eye-popping inflows in the ETFs. So 2 parts to that. I'm curious, for the first part, where's that demand coming from? You know, is it the pensions and the institutions you talked about earlier, or is it the sort of Reddit and Wall Street Bets crowd, or is it even all of the above, I guess, perhaps? And also, you know, as a strategist such as yourself, you know, what's your thinking about how you should allocate your portfolios? And we hypothetically use an alt ETF portfolio, how you would advise, let's just say hypothetically, a middle-aged guy who's got some kids heading to college and is kind of a scaredy cat, a little risk
hypothetical,
averse.
Right? So I think we've definitely seen a widening of the use of ETFs. I mean, ETFs has served really very strongly, certainly through crisis periods like last year, in terms of providing investors with liquidity, transparent pricing, which has meant that its role has certainly expanded. So it's certainly used for increasingly for cash equitization. We saw it used a lot for risk transfer. You know, I want to short something, I don't want to get a bait in the marketplace, or kind of classic swap type arrangements that have been restricted to derivatives, increasingly being used for that. Tactical positioning, I think that's probably been an area that's seen immense growth as liquidity has increased within the ETF landscape, that there is a lot more of that tactical views on either a specific sector, subsector, or of course more broadly in markets. So that's on the usage side of the ETF. In terms of how you should think about your allocation, again keeping your hypothetical person in mind. Clearly a trade-off between how much you want to be in growth versus safety assets and what you do about income. We are biased more towards risk assets. That means equities, to some extent, commodities. We do like those. I think we keep a structural position in both long-duration assets, as I spoke to you about, and we do like gold for its diversifying capabilities, although the incentives for gold have come down with a pickup in yields. I think it's important to also think about alternative ways of making your income. So, you know, should that mean playing more with dividends? Looking at alternatives like convertible or senior loans, infrastructure. So things like that that get you the income statement, given that most investors, and we do advocate in this environment, in general to be underweight bonds. That means you're losing out that income stream to try and put some kind of a structure in place that gets you to the heart of that income stream. And I think alternative assets, as you think about dividends, as I said, as you think about senior loans, converts, those are all becoming more attractive to get to that income streams.
How much should our hypothetical investor who's got a couple of kids heading to college put into the likes of Bitcoin? I mean, you mentioned ETFs. I think there are at least 8 Bitcoin ETFs that have been filed, and we have no idea when the SEC is actually going to greenlight any of these. Speaking of scaredy cats, I mean, there's one, the SEC, when it comes to Bitcoin ETFs. Is Bitcoin something that should be part of your portfolio? Are you looking to perhaps allocate some space to that?
Well, I mean, Bitcoin is a toughie, right? I mean, if you look at the long-term behavior, I mean, you know, Bitcoin's move up has got to do with scarcity, and it's got to do much like gold, and it's got to do with the fact that it's, you know, it's perceived to be a store of value. If you looked at the long-term relationship between using Bitcoin as a hedge in any way, on a long-term basis, it doesn't do much better than gold. In fact, I would say gold is way better than Bitcoin in that regard. More recently, with all the moves that you've seen, it indeed does do a better job of providing some diversification benefit, more in line with gold. But you do have to live with the fact that the volatility is much higher. We do struggle to say whether is it an asset that's a part of a core holding or not. I think it's a tough one to make a call around, but I think that investors need to pay attention to it because of just the fact that it is rising. There's a whole bunch of cryptocurrencies that are coming about. There's a desire for countries to be thinking about digitizing their currency. So given that whole complex and how it's evolving, it does involve consideration. Actually adding it to a portfolio, if everybody did that, then of course demand for these things would spike up like no one's business. So that part needs to be kept in the background. So something worth looking at. I'm not sure I'm ready to step out and say that it's something that's an essential part of investors' portfolios. And if we were choosing, I would say still for that diversification benefit and the fact that you have so much monetary fiscal stimulus occurring on a global basis, gold does indeed have a role to play in your holdings and in your broad asset.
Gaurav, I'm glad that you said gold is better than Bitcoin on this podcast. This is a safe space for ideas like that. If you had taken that take to Twitter, I would have feared for your future mental health. Let's just say. But Gaurav, one last thing before we get to the craziest things we saw in markets this week. I know you've done a lot of work looking at liquidity, and obviously we saw major liquidity issues in the Treasury market last year. After that 7-year note auction a few weeks ago, it almost looked like deja vu to that really sort of liquidity crisis we saw back during the height of the pandemic. If you were going to stay up at night worrying about liquidity in a certain market, would it be the Treasury market, or is it the type of thing where a liquidity crisis, you don't really know where it's going to be until it happens?
I mean, I think that you do need to think about the Treasury market, right? Because you think about the expectations, right? I mean, we do expect there to be, I mean, I'm just drawing extremes here, but we do expect there to be illiquidity as you move away from the dollar to, call it on the other end, to EM currencies, right? I mean, we know liquidity is a lot less in those markets versus here, or Treasuries as you, government securities as you start going out from DM to EM and then EM to smaller countries within that complex. So yes, it does warrant some consideration because it challenges notions about is a market running smoothly or not running smoothly. And that's why investors need to pay attention to what is occurring around that. Again, I don't want to sound alarm bells here. I think that overall, we do think that with all the efforts the Fed has taken, broadly speaking, markets are reasonably well functioning and liquidity in general, liquidity conditions have been pretty reasonable. But again, something we think about, we worry about, because any freeze up in liquidity in Treasuries has a ripple effect that goes through a range of markets.
Yeah, absolutely. The contagion happens instantaneously, I guess.
Instantaneously. Yeah, exactly. And you know, just to reiterate, the effect of U.S. dollar, U.S. treasuries, and U.S. exceptionalism across global markets on a financial basis, I want to be clear, I say that financial basis, not on a trade basis. We've seen every country getting a bit more domestic on a global basis, has just increased post GFC.
Right. Is there any risk to get back to that dollar as the reserve currency? Any risk to that status in your mind? I think that's what the Bitcoin people would tell you on Twitter, but I'm curious what you think.
I mean, you know, as we started putting out our outlook last year, so sort of October, November, we sit down and think about, well, what is it we expect to occur in markets? We definitely advocated that investors need to pay attention to China for a variety of reasons, right? You know, I'm not going to take a political stance here on what my views may be on one versus the other. But I do think that as you look at the efforts the country is putting in place, the Chinese economy is putting in place, BBOC is putting in place to call it, make it a more global currency with an eye on it having reserve status. I think it's definitely something that investors should pay attention to. Investors should pay attention to the fact that it's now the second largest economy, and then you can look at your forecasts. People are more optimistic, pessimistic, but somewhere you're looking at in the next 5 to 10 years, it's likely to be bigger than the US. In that environment, it can be a competitor. So it's something that investors should keep an eye out for.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Scarlett, I often compare the podcast to like a good 4-course meal. And we just had a very nutritious discussion there about markets. Now it's time for the dessert.
Okay.
It's that time.
Tighten up your straitjackets. It's time for the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Scarlett, I have a lot of faith in you to provide us with something good in the craziest things category for this week. What do you have for us?
Okay, so we remember, you and I definitely, because we've got kids heading to college. Can you tell that this is an obsession of mine? The whole Operation Varsity Blues from a couple of years ago, where parents were paying schools, not schools directly, but they're paying Rick Singer for a side door entrance into elite universities. There's a good story on the Bloomberg News terminal today that was talking about Chinese students paying agents, these consulting firms, up to $12,000 for a shot at an entry-level job at investment banks like Goldman Sachs, like JP Morgan. I don't know that these are side doors. It's not quite a side door, and it's not clear that there's anything wrong with this. But these programs offer an inside track to students. They pair them with bankers to help with strategy, networking, drafting letters, internal referrals, touting success, and landing these jobs anywhere from Shanghai to New York. They target all the big major firms. They target Citadel, hedge funds, consultants. It's just an interesting story to keep in mind, Mike, as you and I prepare to spend lots of money on schools, and then in the years to come, lots of money to help them potentially get jobs in Wall Street.
So you're saying I should reserve a spare $12,000 per kid, I guess. All for the right, I should point out, to go work, 23 and a half hours a day on Wall Street.
That's right. Not get enough sleep and work all through Saturday, even though Goldman Sachs and the other firms say that they should get their free Saturdays.
Well, it would all pay off in the long run. I wonder if they get, are they guaranteed a job, or is it a money back guarantee if they can't place your kid in at a bank? I wonder.
I did not see any of that. There's no money back guarantee noted here, but there are a bunch of different websites, a bunch of different firms, so they all have to offer some competitive advantage.
That's pretty interesting. Hey, Garv, what's your offer for getting my kid an internship with you? Well, we'll talk after the podcast. We'll talk.
So I have I'll give you two things to think about. I think that one thing, market space for a second, right? I mean, Wix is below its long-term averages. I mean, that thing just blows my mind out. I think when we look at it, we do recognize there is a lot of good things to look at on the economic environment, but we're sitting on 95% of S&P 500 is above its 200-day moving average, 90% above its 90-day average, VIX at extremely low levels. So complacency, that's something that certainly we spend a lot of time thinking about and care about. And then the other thing that keeps my attention is what's occurring with the Oscars. So as you know, there is there is a lot of heat in that category this year with Chadwick Boseman. I was looking to see if the odds would have shifted between Anthony Hopkins and Riz Ahmed as the first Muslim person to be nominated for the Oscars. And I've seen some shifts occur in that regard. My money is still on Chadwick Boseman, but I'm looking to see if Riz gives him a bit of a run for his money.
Garbs, Scarlett is perking up here. She's like our resident gossip columnist at Bloomberg. If you ever want to catch the latest gossip, check out, and you're on the terminal, check out Scarlett's message 9. She'll give you the latest.
I'll make sure.
So, what's the latest, Scarlett?
Oh my gosh, I have not updated that in a while because I cannot get into the whole influencer economy and the whole reality show economy. Like, I still like my celebrities, you know, minted the old-fashioned way, making movies. So I'm a little out of step here. This podcast is all about showing our age, Mike. What happened? How did you run me into this?
We can't hide anymore. We can't hide. Well, I'll show you how out of touch I am with the influencers of the world with my craziest thing. I'm going all the way back to one of my favorite influencers of all time, and that's Guy Fieri. You remember him?
The restaurant owner.
The
Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. He cut.
Oh, I used to love that show.
Oh, yeah,
yes.
It's great. I could watch that. It's almost like I ate a meal after watching it. It's just so satisfying, the stuff I would never really eat in real life, but I, you know, vicariously live through Guy Fieri. This relates back to the crypto conversation because Bitcoin is just not crazy enough to make it into the craziest things. We've got to go and move on to the new crypto sensation, Dogecoin, or as Katie Greifeld likes to call it, Doggy Coin. And it jumped from 8 cents to 14 cents on, I think it was between Tuesday and Wednesday. And he can laugh, ha ha, 8 cents to 14 cents, whatever. Yeah, that's a 75% gain for anyone who's holding this thing. And it was all because none other than Guy Fieri tweeted out a picture of him in a spacesuit with the Dogecoin mascot. His picture was in the spacesuit helmet. And it said Dogecoin to the moon or something to that extent. So Guy Fieri of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives Fair is now pumping Dogecoin on Twitter. And it seems to be working. A good 4 cent pop or 6 cent pop in Dogecoin, all thanks to the Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives host Guy Fieri. So I don't know how this happens where all of a sudden a guy like that is pumping Dogecoin. If someone got to him and offered some monetary compensation for that tweet, I don't know. I hate to impugn Guy Fieri's character in the crypto markets, but all in all, a pretty good offering of crazy things this week from you two. And I really appreciate your time, Scarlett Fu and Garv Malik. Thank you so much for your time this week.
Enjoyed every minute of it.
Same here. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, great. Well, hopefully we can have you both back again someday and find even crazier things to talk about. What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Our guest host Scarlett is at Scarlett Fu. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Laura Carlson. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.